together. And also, an announcement coming up, we have on September 9th, from Alabama to Oregon, prisoners are striking nationwide September 9th to end prison slavery and white supremacy. Take the streets in solidarity. March to corporate prison profiteers and noise demo at the detention center. September 9th at 2 p.m., folks will be meeting at Chapman Square in downtown Portland. It will begin with a teach-in and an event with the organizers. At 3 o'clock, the march begins, and at 6 p.m., they'll have a noise demonstration in front of the Justice Center, and they will be reconvening at Chapman Square. This event is hosted by or sponsored by Black Lives Matter Portland, the Portland Anarchist Black Cross, the Portland Prison Divestment Coalition, Oregon Jericho, and several other organizations. And so if you have an interest there, one of the other issues that we want to bring to light to folks is that what's going on in our prison systems and the new forms of slavery that they're placing folks under in the name of the law. And so that's contact information. On Facebook, September 9th PDX, September spelled out, 9th NT, 9TH PDX. The contact person, Casey. His email is kcx8742@gmail.com. You can contact Casey for more information for the September 9th event. And thank you very much. And I hope everybody had a pleasant Labor Day.
I just want to add that we'll be talking more about the Fair Shot for All 2017 legislative agenda, about paid family leave and medical leave, insurance, basic health plan, covering kids and reproductive health equality, ending profiling, just cause eviction. That will probably be on our next show. So I just want to make a reminder and announcement to our listeners that the Fair Shot for All 2017 legislative agenda, we'll discuss more on next week.
All right.
Next agenda.
I'd like to once again thank Brother Partridge, who's also a CBTU member.
That's right.
For coming out tonight and letting us know about those two rallies that are taking place on behalf of postal workers and Portland Tenants United. I'd like to remind you that the Coalition of Trade Unionists meets the second Tuesday of every month at 6 p.m. at the American Federation of State County Municipal William Lucy Building. Our next meeting will be September 13th. Thank you very much for joining us this evening, and holla!
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad.
Coming to you from the studios of KBOO Radio in Portland, Oregon, this is Prison Pipeline. Prison Pipeline presents a unique perspective of the criminal justice system, addressing the root causes of crime and broadening understanding of the institution of incarceration. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. There's a lively debate over drug control policy in the U.S. Whichever side they may be on, most people do agree on one thing: we can't arrest our way out of the drug problem. The same is true for mental illness, houselessness, poverty. Yet still, law enforcement gets called on to deal with them, or rather, to deal with people who are experiencing these problems. In Washington state, leaders in King County worked to develop alternatives to give law enforcement more effective options than an arrest. They came up with Law Enforcement Assisted Diversion, or LEAD as it's called. LEAD was first developed in King County as a pilot program in 2011. The idea has spread across the country, with jurisdictions all over the U.S. considering implementation of a LEAD program. To learn more about LEAD, I spoke recently with someone who's been working on it since the very beginning.
My name's Lisa Dugard. I am the director of the Public Defender Association in Seattle, which actually did used to be a public defense office. We now do criminal justice reform work. and work on developing alternatives to replace the reliance that you alluded to in your intro on law enforcement and punitive systems to deal with issues of poverty and behavioral health issues. And in that role, we are part of the partnership that launched the LEAD program in Seattle, King County in 2011. And my office is the program manager for LEAD.
Right. LEAD, the Law Enforcement Assisted Diversion. A lot of people have heard about diversion programs. I mean, people get involved in the criminal justice system because of an arrest. They're found to use alcohol or other drugs. They may get the option of seeking treatment rather than going directly to jail. We have special courts set up for these things, drug courts, family courts. They're all rooted in the idea of therapeutic jurisprudence. Of course, the problem is people are getting arrested and thrown into the criminal justice system in order to get that therapeutic jurisprudence. Law Enforcement Assisted Diversion, the LEAD program, is different from these drug courts. Could you explain the general concept?
Sure. LEAD is sometimes described as drug court without the court, which is a little bit of an oversimplification, but the really important piece that it does capture is that it subtracts the whole infrastructure of the formal justice system, the court, the jail, the prosecutor, the public defender, and all the expense that's attached to that and all the stigma and burden on the defendant from the enterprise of trying to help somebody. So as you alluded to, you know, more than 20 years ago, some folks in the justice system correctly realized that they were engaged in this really counterproductive process of punishing and harming people who were ill and hurting, and that wasn't fair and it wasn't working well. And so there was this turn to the so-called therapeutic courts. That was an improvement over, you know, where we were, but there's still a fallacy embedded in that approach, which is that it in any way is constructive or helps people who are traumatized, ill, hurting, and engaging in behavior that may be problematic but as a result of those conditions. The fallacy is that it is in any way helpful to stigmatize that group of people or to saddle them with the burden of being charged with a crime, often a felony. And then try to help them. So what the innovation of LEAD is really, you know, why don't we just do the part where we help people and make resources available to them? The drug courts that have succeeded and other therapeutic courts that have shown good outcomes, and not all have, but those that have, there's a real lively debate about whether the positive outcomes that you see for some individuals are because of the court part or because they just have preferential access to things like housing and treatment. You know, we don't need to prove that housing and treatment resources and other kinds of services, you know, high quality services really can change things for people. So if what is at work in therapeutic courts that produces good outcomes when those outcomes occur, it's just that people have access to housing and services. Why don't we try to make those housing and services available in the community and see if we can achieve equally good or maybe better outcomes? So when LEAD started in 2011, the idea was for police, we can come back to this question, but we did not think that we could overnight change the fact that police are called to respond to issues of addiction and other behavioral health issues and extreme poverty. That's a habit that our society has developed over a long period of time. You don't have other first responders who you can call a 3-digit number and get them to come out to respond to a situation. We just have the police. So people are going to call the police about addiction-related behaviors. What we thought we could, and not only that, but that police response for the time being is going to play out in a way that's racially skewed. not everybody's drug-related problems generate calls to the police. Some people's drug involvement is sort of coded as criminal in the minds of people in the community, and some people's isn't. So that also, those are deep, entrenched patterns, and we knew that we couldn't turn those around overnight. What we thought we could intervene in with pretty dramatic and immediate results was what happens after the police arrive. So we're trying to insert kind of a diversion ramp from that point of police attention or contact with somebody and say, actually, the most effective thing an officer can do about this situation is to just connect that person to very high quality, what we call guerrilla case managers, in the sense that they will do whatever needs to be done in order to improve the situation of the person. And they don't just sit in offices. They don't just work 9 to 5. So connect somebody to really high quality case manager who's working in a harm reduction framework, so they're not going to withdraw services because somebody continues to use drugs or alcohol. And then sustain that support over time. And by time, I mean many months and in some cases many years, until really entrenched expectations on the part of that person are of being let down, of lack of trust, are improved enough that they can take some really difficult steps to change behaviors like drug use that probably are having a negative impact on them and on the surrounding community. So the police, the role of the police becomes one of, they're essentially a conduit. They really get out of the way and make sure that folks have access to the best support we can provide in their current circumstances. Then the other component that was innovative is that not every kind of criminal charge is divertible. In LEAD in Seattle, those diverted offenses are just drug crimes and prostitution, people being charged for sex work. Those individuals often get charged with other crimes, property crimes, crimes against people. But what the justice system does with those can be very destructive of a recovery path, if you will. I don't mean recovery necessarily in the sense of abstinence, but in the sense of healing. So prosecutors coordinate what's going on with all those other cases with the intervention plan that is put together in LEAD for the person. And they do some remarkable things. They don't file a bunch of cases. They dismiss cases that were filed if the person's doing well. They make release motions so that people don't get stuck in jail and miss treatment or housing opportunities. So basically all the justice system and law enforcement touches with this person that previously would have contributed to destabilization get coordinated with a stabilization and support plan that all happens in the community as much as possible. So that's LEAD.
So it's sort of, in a way, sort of the opposite of a broken windows approach, where you're trying to enforce every petty offense that's out there. It's more of a, I've heard it referred to as pre-arrest, but in some respects, more of a non-arrest. Really, is that fair?
So in the flagship LEAD program, there are two roads into LEAD. One is literally an arrest diversion, so the person is under arrest. They would otherwise be booked into jail, or they could be booked into jail, and instead the officer releases them to a case manager. So in that way, it's a pre-booking diversion program. The other road, though, which is becoming more and more prominent, is actually that the officers just dispense with arrest altogether, because it's kind of an archaic concept once you think of the role of the police differently. Officers actually themselves came up to us and were like, why would I arrest this guy if all I want to do is, you know, help him get housing and that's his problem? So they are just working with people way upstream. They don't wait until they have probable cause to arrest somebody. They have a lot of street-based contacts with folks. They know what's going on. The individuals know that the officers know that they're, you know, engaged in low-level theft or other property crimes in order to support their drug use, and officers know what's going on. So they have this conversation in which information is exchanged that's not normally exchanged with a police officer, because individuals on the street now see officers often as a portal to support and help rather than stigmatization and punishment. So these are called social contact referrals, and that, I think, is the most promising takeaway so far from the LEAD experiment, which has now been, it's not really an experiment, but the innovation of LEAD, which has been running for nearly 5 years, which is that it is possible to radically transform the function and role of the police. You don't have to eliminate law enforcement altogether to reduce or eliminate the destructive impact that policing has had in poor communities and communities of color as a result of broken windows. One of the policy level takeaways is that, you know, the appeal of broken windows was that it took seriously public order issues. It is problematic to have the behavior that people engage in when they don't have a place to live, when they are addicted, when they don't have an income, when they do have mental illness, and all of that is playing out on the streets and in the parks. That I think, you know, actually a large cross-section of the public can agree that's not great, not how the community should look. But that doesn't mean that the response to that from the police needs to be to incarcerate people and punish them and dehumanize them. You can take those problems seriously and still have the police play a constructive humanizing role, or not humanizing, but a role that recognizes the humanity, the essential humanity of the folks that they're encountering. And so LEAD has emerged as, I think, the competitor or the challenger to the broken windows paradigm, which has appealed to lots of people, including in poor neighborhoods. But it turns out you don't have to subscribe to this overly punitive model in order to take those problems seriously and in order to give the police a role to play.
You are listening to Prison Pipeline. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Our guest is Lisa Dugard, director of the Public Defender Association in King County, Seattle, Washington. We're talking about the Law Enforcement Assisted Diversion Program, which has been in operation in King County since 2011, and which municipalities around the nation are considering implementing. How are you getting buy-in from stakeholders like the business community in a program like LEAD? Because those are the people I would imagine are the most, the kind of people who call the police when there's a homeless person who's nearby because, oh, my customers might get concerned, or, oh, the tourists. How do you deal with those people?
Well, those people have become the shock troops of revolutionary change, actually. It's been really eye-opening for me to find that, I was a public defender for many years, and I used to think of, quote-unquote, those people, the business associations and the public safety councils that exist in every city in the country. I thought of them as the enemy, to be quite frank. I thought they wanted my clients to be in jail, in prison for essentially, you know, behavior that wasn't really their fault. So I now regret all those years that I had that mentality, because I think that they were potential allies that people like me just didn't have a big enough imagination to see. It turns out, you know, that all these years, that constituency has been offered a choice between more or less response to their problems. But the response was sort of, it had one gear, and it was more arrests and longer jail sentences, longer prison sentences. And so that when they're offered more or less, they voted for more, which most people do. You know, do you want more attention to your problem? Yes, I do. What happened with LEAD is that we took what felt at the time like a huge chance, and we went into the meetings of these groups and said, because at the time, this was in, you know, 2010, kind of the high watermark of incarceration and reliance on the justice system had been reached. It was kind of like peak oil. We had kind of reached peak jail. In the middle of the recession, people knew they couldn't build infinitely more jails and infinitely more judges and courtrooms and stuff. They were still really dissatisfied with the condition on the street. So it was the perfect time to ask the question, do you want to try something else? Because they were really fed up with the status quo, and the status quo was hyper-incarceration. And when they said, you know, we're willing to spend time on your problems, so that was the change on our part. We did not trivialize their problems. We did not say that they had no reason to be concerned. We're like, we get it. You know, having drugs sold on your street corner or in front of your coffee shop sucks. Do you want to really change that? Should we try something different and not just more of the same, which isn't even affordable? To our astonishment, they said, absolutely. And I really am not exaggerating when I say that virtually every residence council, business association, neighborhood council, public safety group in Seattle has rallied around this approach. They want it to work, which is completely reasonable, and they have needed us to be very serious about making it work. So we had to, you know, do rigorous evaluation. We've had to maintain continuous dialogue with all those partners. And again, I can't stress enough, that's not how people on my side of the equation normally work. So if we want to make these partnerships flourish, we have to really step up and deliver. We have to say that we intend to achieve better street-level results than the status quo did, and we have to deliver on that. The thing is, it's not hard to do that because the status quo was failing everyone miserably. And so LEED is imperfect. We're not achieving the level of outcomes that I think we would all like to see, not from lack of effort, but honestly from lack of resources. We don't have places for a lot of people to live. Most of the folks in LEED have extensive criminal history, and they are precluded from housing in most of the housing programs and in the private housing market. There are still insufficient treatment resources. People have been, you know, thoroughly traumatized for decades, sometimes intergenerationally, and so that recovery from that takes a long time. So everything's not perfect, but it's better than it was, and the process itself also is one that is more transparent and more accountable to those community stakeholders. So I'm really glad to report that it is possible to find common ground between neighborhood safety champions and civil rights forces on these basic issues of what the police should be doing.
How has the expansion of LEED gone in the last couple of years?
Well, there's been, as you say, an explosion of interest around the country, and you know, in part, I think, because people are very attracted to the, and they're attracted to the positive outcomes for individuals that the evaluation found. They're also attracted to the transformation of the relationships and dynamics among previously opposed forces that we've seen in our community after we started working together in this way. So the level of collaboration between civil rights leaders, prosecutors, police, human services agencies, and our participants, people living with addiction on the street, the dramatic change in the nature of those relationships, I think, is another reason why this has proven to be so attractive to other jurisdictions. It's not just that, you know, everybody knows the war on drugs has failed, but what comes next, right? I mean, just standing down in the face of addiction and its impact is not very satisfying as a policy position. So something needs to fill that void. What is that? There are not very many compelling answers. So LEED, you know, begins to answer that question. But I think also it's important that that LEED arose at a moment when there's been a crisis about the role of the police in American cities. And so the fact that people like me, who, I mean, I literally used to roll out of bed every morning with a mission of getting in the way of any law enforcement officer that I saw, not literally getting in the way, not usually, but in court or in my work, you know, whatever police wanted, I wanted to stop that. So that I don't feel that way anymore. I work very closely with lots of police officers who I used to cross-examine in court, and they didn't like me, and I didn't like them, maybe I'm not liking. So we are now, you know, sincere partners with a lot of mutual respect. The same is true of people who I represented who report radically different experiences with these very same officers who used to arrest them, you know, week after week on the street. And they now, you know, they approach those officers, they're very open with them about their struggles. You know, there are conversations with police all the time now about, you know, I relapsed, I had to shoot up this morning, I'm not doing very well. So that transformative impact obviously is very meaningful when people around the country are wrestling with fundamental questions about how can we change police community dynamics? How can we, is it even possible actually to to restore respect and humanity in those dynamics? When people come to Seattle and look at LEAD, that's what they're witnessing. And I think it's injected a lot of hope. Now, LEAD has been adapted to different circumstances in different communities, and that's absolutely fine. That's as it should be. There are some core principles that have made it work here. And so the LEAD National Support Bureau that you referenced, that we've stood that up in order to ensure that when LEAD is replicated around the country, there's fidelity to these core principles that make it LEAD. And harm reduction is one of them. Getting buy-in from rank-and-file officers is one of them. Being very transparent with and accountable to community public safety leaders is one of them. And coordinating with prosecutors on all the other cases that people have in court, and making sure that the entire web of the justice system is mitigated when it comes to what happens to these LEAD participants. That's also one of our core principles. So we want to make sure that other communities that start down this road have a good experience. It's not easy to do this well, and it's easy to do it poorly. So we want to make sure that, to the extent possible, other jurisdictions avoid failure and have a positive experience, as we have. Again, it's not going to be perfect, but we want people to feel like it's a direction worth continuing.
I've been following the development of LEAD for the last few years now. It's such an incredibly promising program. I just wish you continuing success. Again, we've been speaking with Lisa Dugard, the Public Defender Association. Lisa, we're coming up to the end of the hour. The clock has beaten us once again. Don't know how it does that. I think it cheats. So any closing thoughts for the listeners, and where can people find out more about law enforcement assisted diversion, the website and all that, and the Public Defender Association website too? You've got some other good projects going on there.
Thanks so much, Doug, for the opportunity and the fantastic questions. So for information about LEAD, the LEAD National Support Bureau is at www.leadbureau.org. And then information on the flagship program in Seattle, King County, is at LEAD King County, K-I-N-G County, .org. And then my office is the Public Defender Association. That's at www.defender.org. And we do work on police reform, other similar issues of building and implementing public health-based solutions for problems that traditionally have been addressed through policing and over-incarceration. So we would love to meet people on those sites and communicate further. I really appreciate your time, and as I say, those were great questions.
Lisa, thank you so very much for your time and for all the work that you're doing. I just wish you all the best luck.
Thank you so much. Look forward to talking in the future.
All right. Cheers. That was from a conversation with Lisa Dugard, Director of the Public Defender Association in King County, Seattle, Washington. We were speaking about the Law Enforcement Assisted Diversion, or LEAD, program that began in King County and is now spreading across the United States. For more information, go to leadbureau.org. That's it for this week. Thank you for listening. This has been Prison Pipeline. You can find this and previous installments of the show on the web at kboo.fm/prisonpipeline.
Prison Pipeline has a Facebook page. Please give it a like. My thanks to our guest, Lisa Dugard from the Public Defender Association and the LEAD National Bureau. Thanks to our engineers. And of course, thank you, dear listener, for joining us. I'm Doug McVeigh. So long. Just a soul's intentions are good. Oh, Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood. Don't let me be misunderstood. I try so hard, so please don't let me be.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Institute for Anarchist Studies 20th Anniversary Celebration on Friday, September 9th at Audio Cinema in Portland. The Institute for Anarchist Studies is an organization that gives grants to radical writers, publishes the journal Perspectives on Anarchist Theory, and engages in educational activities. This event features Portland DJs Katie Pants and Nathan Carson and a performance by Mike Crenshaw. Again, that's the Institute for Anarchist Studies 20th Anniversary Celebration, Friday, September 9th, starting at 8 p.m. at Audio Cinema, 226 Southeast Madison Street in Portland. For more information, go to kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of The Other September 11th, Not Forgiven and Not Forgotten, a film screening on Sunday, September 11th at People's Food Co-op in Portland. In 1973, Chile experienced a coup by right-wing forces led by Augusto Pinochet. No Forgiving, No Forgetting is often painted on walls or written on